you mind running that by me again?
Hey, what the heck is fair?
Used.
This might sound crazy, but
they're
limitations
on copy, right?
Is it possible?
Off, isn't it? Hey, there we go. Oh, no. You are listening to WREK Atlanta, and this is Lost in the Stacks, the original research library rock and roll radio show. Our batter is not crispy. I am Charlie, and my co-host is Amit.
Hey, everyone.
And we both work at the Georgia Tech Library. Josh is on the board, and we've already thrown him deep in the soup.
Yep, that's me, guys. Glad to be back.
Fred is here, and for the next hour, we've all got music and library talk for you. Whichever you're here for, we hope you dig it.
Today's show is about the intersection of artists' desire to own the things they create versus the ownership that we all have in our shared culture.
That's pretty complex. Can you sum that up?
We're calling it copyright, hawks and doves.
A copyright hawk is someone who wants to protect and control all aspects of use and dissemination of a copyrighted work. On the other hand, copyright dove would advocate for a more open and less restrictive copyright system.
And our guest today is David Lowry, who calls himself a copyright hawk. And yes, he'll talk about how copyright benefits him as an artist in his groups Camper Van Beethoven and Cracker, but he'll also talk about times that he's taken advantage of exemptions to copyright law.
Ooh. If you, our listeners, want to join the conversation, the hashtag for this show is LITS338. For Lost in the Stacks, episode 338. Feel free to use that hashtag to tweet your thoughts, reactions, or bird imitations anytime during this show, or if you're listening to the podcast later. It can be asynchronous.
You know, hawks up against doves, I think the hawks usually can win.
What if the doves have machine guns?
Our songs today, well, hey, you know, I'm looking at the script and there's not nearly as much music as there usually is.
And there's some weird segment.
Yeah.
Claps. What?
Sorry about that, guys. The interview is going to run a few minutes longer than our usual format, so the music is a little reduced, but it's all going to relate to the theme of the day.
And those themes are copyright and fair use. The hawks and doves of copyright are forces that coexist in opposition. So let's start with a song about opposing forces. This is Good Guys and Bad Guys by who else? Camper Van Beethoven, right here on Lost in the Stacks.
This is Lost in the Stacks, and today's guest is David Lowry, a music business lecturer at the University of Georgia, and he is well known for his musical projects, Camper Van Beethoven and Cracker. He is also author of the Tricordist blog, which is a website where artists' rights on copyright and intellectual property are a frequent subject of discussion. David, welcome back to Lost in the Stacks.
Thanks. I've been on your show twice now, right?
Yeah. Last time it was about artist rights in the world of streaming Spotify and YouTube. And that was even before you maybe entered the legal battle.
The class action lawsuit.
It was more of a mental, intellectual battle. And then, and then it became an actual battle.
Yeah, that's in the courts now. I don't really have anything to do with it. The thing about a class action is, I just remind people about this, is they're not always as adversarial as you think. They can be a way for resolving these issues, wiping the slate clean and coming up with a plan for going forward. So hopefully we see some of that resolved.
So when we talked about that last time, that was getting into the area of artist rights as filtered through the lens of streaming. And today on the show, we're talking about artist rights through the lens of copyright.
Copyright and fair use.
Right. And you are a lecturer at the University of Georgia in music business. What do you tell your students about copyright, I guess specifically in the music industry, like what their rights are and what it means to them?
Right. So I teach one of the classes I teach is the music publishing class. It's probably best to start with what I teach there. Music publishing refers to the rights and exploitation of the compositions in abstract rather than like the recordings. So some more songwriters. Mm-hmm. But the first 2 weeks we actually spend on sort of the history of like how copyright arose, you know, like in Venice, you first started seeing some things that looked like copyrights where book publishers, you know, were given.
This is in the early days of publishing.
14, right? Yeah, soon after the printing press is developed, where you start seeing, you know, the actual printing press publishers, you know, be given exclusive rights to a certain, you know, manuscript or something like that. And the purpose being to protect, in this case, it was the right of the publisher, because often they were reprinting things from antiquities, you know, like Greek and Roman, you know, books or plays or books of poetry.
So even back then, they were taking advantage of things that were in the public domain, even though that concept mm-hmm. didn't exist. But as we would see,
yeah,
today,
it was in the public domain. And what the work for a publisher was in those days is they had to, you know, these things were often fragments, and they had to send people out scouring, you know, the old sort of classical world trying to find a full copy of a work, you know, and then translating it and you know, all kinds of stuff like that just to put it together, right? And so then, you know, a rival publisher, you know, they'd get the first publisher does all sort of all the trailblazing to get the, you know, this reproduction mm-hmm. out there, translation. And then, you know, the guy next door just starts printing up his own copies of it and stuff like that. And so, you know, it was sort of seen as a, you know, as legal experts would say, you know, there was a sense of a moral wrong that sort mm-hmm. of needed to be, you know, sort of corrected with some sort of law or, you know, regulation or something like that. So often a publisher would get the license basically to print a certain book that they had done the work on for, you know, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years and stuff like that.
Right.
Publish it.
So it's the right to copy, hence yeah. copyright.
Yeah.
So fast forward a few hundred years, I guess, yes. to our current right. situation. Under U.S. law, copyright is automatically granted to a creator of a creative thing, whether mm-hmm. it's a photograph, you know, a song, or
sculpture,
something.
A movie, a play,
and it lasts that right. It lasts for the lifetime of the creator plus 70 years.
Right.
Right,
that's correct.
And so that, and still, just like in the, you know, medieval Venice, mm-hmm. Or maybe that's 1400s. I guess that's not medieval. That's more.
I guess that's for them. It's early Enlightenment.
Right.
It's for Northern Europe, it's not so enlightened yet.
I need to brush up on my European history. But
well,
it's still the same concept that the creator uses that protection to exclusively sell or license or share or otherwise exploit that work.
Right, and the idea is to incentivize the production of these works.
Okay.
Right.
So you being an artist, a working uh-huh. artist for a long time, how or what role has copyright played in your career as a performing musician and as a songwriter?
Right. Well, so now one key difference between that early Renaissance, Enlightenment period, or whatever that is, I'm not mm-hmm. a historian.
Yeah.
Is that now we've, starting with England in the Statute of Anne, we vest the copyright not in, say, the publisher. We vest it in the author, okay? So it's more like an individual right. And then the author or the individual can then lease, rent, sell that right to other people, right? So first of all, I directly own my copyrights, you know, that is. So when a music company comes to me, say a recording company or say a music publisher or a film company or whatever comes to me and wants to use one of my songs, it's clear that I'm the owner and I have the right to negotiate a fee.
You haven't sold it or sent it to a third party, which is something you can do.
Yes, right? You can. Well, this is what's interesting. I took the path that a lot of songwriter performers take, mm-hmm. which is to hold on to the copyright for the underlying composition, mm-hmm. but then essentially sell the recordings to record labels or to make those recordings almost as works for hire with the record labels, right? So the record label ends up owning the recording, may pay you a royalty or something like a residual on the exploitation of the recording, but I own the underlying compositions and works. And this allows me to do several things. This allows me to make a different version of the song, you know, make mm-hmm. and record an entirely different recording of the song that may sound just like the one that the record company has. But it allows me a lot more control over my works by hanging on to the composition. Now, some songwriters, performers will also sell their songs off as well too. And, you know, the reason for this is it's not necessarily completely irrational. You know, sometimes if you sell your compositions off to somebody, say like a Warner Music Group, they might allow you to retain some ownership of it. You might sell 50% of it or something like that, and you will get, you know, performance royalties and things like this. But they might place it with a big star, or they might place it in a large film, or get it into a commercial. And so sometimes people sell these things off because ultimately down the road they might make more money, you know, because a bigger company is better able to exploit these compositions. But generally, I'm not really in that camp. I'm one of the people that believe just hold on to your compositions.
Right. It's your intellectual property.
Yeah. And so, basically, I have my choice of how I want to license this, what for what price, if I want to, you know, do something for a percentage of revenue, if I just want a flat fee, if somebody wants to sample a work, I can listen to it and say yes or no, and then maybe negotiate a price for that or whatever. So in general, yeah, I retain control over my works.
And right now, under copyright law, it is that control lasts for the lifetime of the author,
right?
Plus 70 years. And in your view, do you think that is too long? And what I mean is there at some point where, you know, you write some songs for an album like Key Lime Pie, one of your mm-hmm. successful right. albums. At some point, does that become part of our shared culture and that control that you currently uh-huh. exert over that? Like who can access it, you know, for what price right. and things like that. Is there a certain timeline in your mind where those things don't get decided by you anymore? Or is current copyright law accurately or fairly deciding mm-hmm. that?
I could live with shortening the term. I think 70 years, by most of the stuff is fairly, there's not much commercial value mm-hmm. once it's that long, and it's probably, there is not much commercial value in the work. In the same sort of way there is when it's a fresher, newer work, you know, after 50 years, after 40 years, I don't know exactly the length of time that it should be shortened to, but I think it's actually pretty reasonable to conclude that you could shorten it some, and it wouldn't really hurt authors, and it would probably be better for our shared cultural heritage. I think I accept that idea. I'm actually always a little more disturbed that the length of copyright has to do with the life of the author, because it's kind of arbitrary. You know, some people are mm-hmm. cut down in their prime, you know, but so their heirs have works that are considerably shorter, right? So mm-hmm. to me, one thing that probably should be done is the work should probably have a fixed length like they have for works for hire. And again, I'm not, I mean, we could debate the length. I think most of the stuff that you see peeking into the public domain right now, as far as songs go and stuff like that, a lot of it is really, you know, I mean, 30 Rock has a great sort of parody of this. They have their, it's in the last season, I think, of 30 Rock, and Liz Lemon is executive producing a show with Jenna, Kids Got Singing, America's Kids Got Singing or something.
Oh, yeah.
Loosely based on, you know, one of these, you know, singing shows. And, and it's, they're having public domain week because they don't have enough money. So, you know, in the background, all the kids are singing like Camp Town Races.
Yeah, it's all Stephen Foster songs.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, by the time the Stephen Foster songs got into the public domain, I mean, you know... Well, actually, I don't really know the history of that. They probably came into the public domain a lot sooner because they came into the public domain a lot sooner because copyright lengths weren't as long then.
Right. I think when it was first written into the Constitution, it is a constitutional law.
Well, the length is not so much in the Constitution,
but the idea of copyright.
Yeah,
but
yeah, I think, the idea of copyright is in.
I guess I should say that the original length was in the U.S. I believe 14 years back when it was.
We were
first.
Matching the U.K. We used to just match whatever the U.K. did.
Right.
So it was 14 years, and then
it didn't matter what your lifespan was or anything like that.
And then just, it was two terms of 14 years. Mm-hmm. A renewable term of 14 years, which, you know, that's another argument, too. See, I'm known as a copyright hawk, but, you know, in some way, you want to protect people who are not sophisticated so that they, you know, they don't lose their copyrights or somebody else picks them up or something like that. You know, like say somebody inherits some copyrights and they don't really aren't sophisticated enough to know the law because they hadn't been in the music publishing business. You want the heirs to not, you know, one of the reasons we got rid of the, you had to sort of go and renew the copyright was because people were losing their copyrights just because they didn't know how the law worked and stuff like that. So you sort of want to protect unsophisticated people. But on the other hand, you know, you also end up with a lot of stuff out there that people are no longer really commercially shepherding or working with or even laying claim of ownership to. And, you know, so I'm kind of two minds on this. In some ways, the registrations, having you to actually renew copyright would help with the fact that there's all this sort of, I think people have been calling it orphan works lately, would help with what, there, you know, with orphan works.
And an orphan work is something where that it could be under copyright, but it's not exactly known what the copyright status is, not exactly certain who
not sure
owns.
When it was created, not sure who owns it. And I imagine libraries and archives have tons of stuff like that, right? So
and our mission is in the library professional ethic is to share as much as possible with as many people as possible.
Exactly.
So sometimes, you know, our views
on... And this
on,
is where we get into a...
Right, there's a tension there. And like you mentioned being known as a copyright hawk, and maybe librarians like myself are more known as copyright doves, where we're more inclined to have that, you know, I guess relaxed or advocate for a more relaxed copyright policy.
And in certain areas, yes.
And we'll be back to continue our discussion with David Lowry after this short break.
Okay, we're close to the midpoint of the show, and this is about the time when normally we have like a quote or an anecdote. Amit calls it the amen break after the Winstons. But this is a long interview. We had to cut it down to fit the show. The full interview will actually go out on our podcast feed next week. But right now, I think we need to make up some time.
So how about a quick instrumental break, and then we'll get right back into the interview?
Oh, I like that. Okay, file this set under KF3030.1.P37.
Okay, that was Steve's Hornpipe by Cracker. That was a tune written in the centuries-old hornpipe tradition.
Yeah, Fred, you think the bumper's going to come in and get you out of that?
Oh, does that need some more explanation?
I want you to explain why that's the track.
Okay, well, okay. Cracker's one of David Lowery's bands.
And that's an easy one, yeah. I'm with you on that.
Okay, so Steve's Hornpipe, it's a hornpipe song, you know, like a sailor's hornpipe, you know, that's that.
I'm also clear on that.
So that's a new song that is copyrighted, that's like written in a tradition that's part of our culture, part of the public domain. You know, there's the kind of overlap there.
Okay, you
it's the hawk and dove.
Are on thin ice right now.
Hi, this is Steve Albini. I'm a recording engineer, and I'm in the band Shellac of North America. And you are listening to Lost in the Stacks on WREK.
And now, let's return to our discussion of copyright Hawks and Doves with David Lowery, a music business lecturer at the University of Georgia, and also a member of the bands Camper Van Beethoven and Cracker. This is Lost in the Stacks, and today's guest is David Lowery, a music business lecturer at the University of Georgia, and he is well known for his musical projects, Camper Van Beethoven, and...
Oh, look at that. So that was the first segment, yes? Fred, do you think we should play the second segment, or should we play the first segment again?
I think we should play the second segment.
Yeah, Fred says the second segment. Josh, what I'm doing now is I'm filling time. I'm going to wait for you to give me a thumbs up. Before you're, look at that. Okay, so there was Steve Albini, and then it was Fred and Dave Lowery, Camper Van Beethoven, Cracker, Steve's Hornpipe, which I still, and now back to the interview.
Advocacy for or against like being a copyright hawk or dove?
Well, I think one of the things that I've learned in sort of these debates is that really each kind of different artistic work sort of has its own sort of characteristics of how it's commercially exploited, how these things are created. And we do kind of have one thing that might actually get us to some common ground on this is if maybe there was some way of not having a one size fits all for registration or renewals and stuff like that, right?
Right.
Now, if you're a librarian, let's say, and you come across a shoebox full of photographs and they're of some interesting historical value, but you don't know who the author is, and these photos, you could probably display the work in your library, right? Or allow people access to it.
Right. And that's, you know, just like with books or phonograph recordings, you know, we have it there, but that's the physical thing. Mm-hmm. Where it's causing the most tension, I think, these days is the fact that it's 2017 and sharing anymore is digital.
Right.
And libraries really are bound by the copyright rules and regulations not to digitally share a thing. Like, we'll use Key Lime Pie as an example. Mm-hmm. Again, if we had a patron that wanted that, if we had a CD, we're perfectly within our rights in the U.S. code to lend you a copy and then, you know, send you on your way, and you just turn it in whenever the due date is.
Right of first sale,
cannot,
so it gives you that.
Right, yeah. We cannot just send you the MP3s of the song. And I think we're getting into a point where, you know, the digital aspect of sharing is just becoming so overwhelming to libraries, and the copyright regulations were really built for this, at least as far as libraries are concerned, built for this physical area. So we're trying to come to terms with how we can share things digitally, and that is where, you know, kind of the tension between copyright hawks like yourself might kind of come into conflict with librarians who have a more dovish view.
Right. Well, so what I was saying is, like, if you take off the different, so I think the protocols that we follow for, you know, registering copyrights and stuff like that are actually are okay for a songwriter, for instance. But let me just show you. But like for a photographer, they click, like if they would have to register, you know, the photographers will snap off, especially in this digital age. They'll take thousands of photographs in a single session when they're a commercial author. And so it's difficult for them to register every single photo, right? So each, what I'm trying to say is that each, we probably should look at, instead of sort of a one size fits all system for the different things that we're copywriting and for the different uses, we should probably figure out exemptions that, I mean, we already have some of this. We have a few exemptions for libraries, for instance. We should probably figure out if we can, should try to figure out if we can get some exemptions for libraries that make sense, that don't interfere, so that libraries can kind of continue on their mission in a digital way, that don't end up interfering with the commercial sort of, the copyrights that are going out there, you know, sort of with a more, you know, sort of commercial endeavor, you know, going on and stuff like that.
Right.
I think you could separate out, we could carve out, I mean, because as it is right now, I mean, you literally couldn't, you could make archive backup copies of, say, something that you have come into your possession in the library. See, this is the part of copyright law I don't know, so you'll have to help me here, right?
Yeah.
But the idea is that you then couldn't display those as sort of a work on your library's webpage. Look at all these wonderful photos that we found of like early gold mining in northern Georgia or something like that. Gold mining in northern Georgia?
Probably. there might have been prospectors anyway. I think that that reproduction exemption for libraries, it's like if we had a copy of your CD and it was wearing out and we made a copy because that physical copy that we had bought lawfully was wearing out. That's like, but yeah, we can't put it on the library website and say, here's the digital version, you know, go ahead. And I can see, you know, the artist side of that, because you put a lot of work into creating that and you're still financially gaining from it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not like a huge revenue stream, but we make money from it every day, every week, every month, you know, something comes in from it. So we don't want it completely shared, but so what I'm trying to get at is, and I think a lot of smart people have been working on this, but I'm not necessarily as a copyright hawk. I'm more of a copyright hawk when it comes to the stuff that is clearly intended to be, you know, commercial.
Yeah.
You know, it's a commercial endeavor. We need to protect those copies because it's how we're being incentivized. That's how our business is built. That's how we find time to create these works and stuff like that. We could look at academic authors. You know, academic authers.
Different model.
Totally different model, right? Academic authors are essentially often paid in, you know, they get tenure by publishing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They may get pay raises by publishing a certain amount. They may get higher status and move on to different institutions and stuff like that. So they're not being directly compensated for these works. And I know a lot of times, a lot of academic authors will just go, you know, even if it's published with a commercial academic journal, we'll just hand out their PDFs of their works
their
and
interest.
Stuff like it's not in their interest. And this actually is because they're treating it as a public good, a little bit of they're treating it as a public good, which public goods, you know, it's non-rivalrous. Just because a bunch of people have a copy of it doesn't make it any less valuable. In fact, in another way, kind of almost makes it, the more widespread it is, the sort of the more gravitas or value it has to that academic author. Whereas if you were trying to commercialize it and sell each individual copy, spreading it everywhere works against that, you know. So when we have different motivations for different copyright owners.
And plus, a lot of times, I'd say the vast majority of times, that work that's produced is funded by taxpayer dollars.
Funded by tax. I mean, even at private institutions, there's such an infusion of federal, local, state,
NSF,
capital,
National Science Foundation
funds into these systems. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. I mean, it is a weird system that we have now, and it's got some inherent contradictions in it.
So I want to divert a little bit. You talked about how, you know, you've taken advantage of fair use. You know, mm-hmm. you've been you know, characterize yourself as a copyright hawk, but you do also, you know, recognize fair use. And you, along with your band Camper Van Beethoven, recorded an entire cover version of the Fleetwood Mac album, the undervalued classic.
Underrated. Critically dismissed album.
Tusk. Which came just a couple years after Rumors, when they had like success that was just unimaginable. And you guys did a cover of every single like song. It's kind of like doing a shot-by-shot remake of a film, but things change in those remakes. So I'm just interested to know, like, did you approach that as, well, with an attitude of like fair use, or did you get a license to do this? How did that come about?
Well, once somebody has commercially released a song, so this is where songs are treated a little different in the Copyright Act, and that's why I think we could treat different works in different situations in different ways. So, for instance, for songs, people have a tendency, you know, some cover band out in, you know, Grants Pass, Oregon, wants to cover a Cracker song, they can get a license to do that. And it's a matter of just, you send this sort of semi-formal notice that you can look up anywhere on the internet. It's one page, and you send it to the copyright holder, right? Or you can do it through a clearinghouse like the Harry Fox Agency. You just do it online or whatever like that. So you can get a license. There's a compulsory license to cover songs. So on one hand, this Tusk cover album, we relied on the federal compulsory license that once you've commercially released a song, anybody else can cover it. And as long as we follow the rules, which is, you know, the notification and that we pay the songwriters, the writers of the Tusk album, which is largely Lindsey Buckingham. He wrote, it's kind of his album in a way, not exclusively.
Stevie Nicks and Christine McVie did write a few songs on
but
there.
But there's heavy Lindsey.
Mostly Lindsey Buckingham.
Yeah, and so, you know, as long as we're sending the royalties to them, we're all cool. But that doesn't necessarily, there's sort of adjoining rights and what they, in other countries, might call moral rights and stuff like that when you go and you cover a whole album. Right.
Okay.
Now you're starting to maybe go beyond the compulsory licenses, but and plus the compulsory licenses restrict you to what they call minor changes in to the song. Like you can change the key, you can change the tempo, you can change it to another style, and if you have to change the tempo to match that style, that's okay. You can change a pronoun here and there, you know, stuff like that. But you're not supposed to really radically remake the songs.
Okay.
So this is where we take the first little step into where, okay, we're going to have to rely on some exemptions to copyright. But the intention of this was we actually viewed what we were doing as not so much a parody. Parody can count as a fair use exemption.
Right.
But it counts as a fair use exemption because it's commentary upon the work on which you're quoting.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided that since what we're trying to do is rehabilitate this work in the eyes of music fans, in a way, we're creating a commentary on Tusk by doing the whole album and maybe not always sticking to the script and making changes that are beyond what the compulsory license would allow. So now we're relying on, you know, quotation in order to do commentary which is one of the elements of fair use exemptions to copyright.
So it's kind of a combination of things here. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to take an example because I recently re-listened to both albums. And, you know, a song like, there's some songs that are faithful, like as you mentioned, which would fall under that compulsory license that you're talking about. But there's some songs like I'm going to take a Christine McVie composition, Brown Eyes, which on the original album is very much a 70s singer songwriter kind of, you know, ballad, which she did. She didn't get weird like Lindsey Buckingham did that album.
Right.
She kind of stuck to her her artistic
guns. She stuck
guns.
To the script.
Right. Yeah. but the Camper Van Beethoven version of Brown Eyes is like a psychedelic swirling kind of, it's radically changed. And so that, you think maybe you were edging off of that license, and because you were edging off of that license, that is commentary on that song, and you're relying on being covered by fair use. And obviously, I mean, it's not a settled thing. Fair use is always, you know, it depends, and it was never settled unless a judge says.
Yes, exactly.
Yes or no.
It lives in jurisprudence land, right? But, for instance, with Brown Eyes, there was something that just... You know, I mean, in a way, what we're saying is like, here are the elements of the song that we like, that are the elements like the words. But imagine if it were in this context.
Right. Okay.
And look what this becomes when you do that. And and I mean, we did this really fast. So sometimes we did this and it'd be like, oh, well, I don't know if that worked, but we have to put it out because this is what we set out to do. Right. And other ones, I think, you know, sort of the changes, you know, I mean, they just, okay, so the album title Tusk exaggerates what that song really is, right? The album song Tusk, if you listen to that, you know, the Fleetwood Mac version, it's sort of, okay, well, it's sort of this pop song, but it's got the USC marching band playing, and that's odd. Mm-hmm. And you know, you got a stadium of people, you know, and then it goes into sort of this drum break, and it does all these things that pop songs wouldn't do, right? Mm-hmm. So we take that song and we just exaggerate it more. You know, it's like there's a drumulator loop that just loops through it, and so you take the little drum section from the marching band, and then you just loop it monotonously, you know, hypnotically.
Did you actually use elements from the original recording in that? Did you loop original recording in your version?
No, we didn't, because that, when you use an actual recording, there's a very poor fair use argument.
Right.
So we didn't use elements of that. So no, we never used, at least not that I know of, but who knows, what it was, pretty crazy session. But no,
there were lots of people in the studio.
Yeah, lots of people, studio, things were happening. There were a lot of drugs. No, unfortunately there wasn't, but that could have been part of the experiment with the, because apparently that was a big part of the Tusk, original Tusk recording. But no, I mean, we used all kinds of elements in that, but we tried to exaggerate each element of that song to kind of to say, this is really was a weird song to be on the radio. And so, of course, we turn it into like, I don't know how long it is on the radio.
It's long
album,
on
like
your
15
version.
Minutes
right.
or something. It's probably not 15 minutes, but it's really long. And we exaggerate the freak
the
out.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we play with the drum loop the way maybe a DJ in the early 2000s would have sort of messed with the drum machine, you know. We took it, we played with it, we commented upon it in musical ways.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, fair use is a strange beast, but it's designed for us to be able to pull ideas and commentary, you know, pull the ideas out of other works and the commentary out of other works and such like, and comment on other works and stuff like that, to be able to use these other works in a way that do not displace sales, essentially, for the other works. I mean, there's other reasons for it, too. But that's one of the designs of it, right?
So I want to ask, do you consider yourself a definitely 100% in the copyright hawk camp, or are you in the dove camp, or maybe in between jackalope camp?
I never regarded myself as being in the hawk camp until I feel like we really started to go off the rails, and so just my position that I've been holding for a long time has sort of come out to be, you know, as a copyright hawk. But I mean, you know, ask me about the Marvin Gaye case, you know, versus Pharrell and Robin Thicke.
This is for Blurred Lines.
Yeah, for Blurred Lines. Mm-hmm. I think the jury made a mistake with that one. I don't know. I'd have to really look at it. I know there was sheet music. When you looked at the sheet music, some element of it was really the same, but it's not the predominant element that I'm hearing when I listen to that song. And I think that being influenced by somebody's work, that's not a copyright infringement, you know, whether it was cool for them to do it or not, I'm not sure, but I don't think that was, you know, the Sam Smith one where he has a song that sounds a lot like Tom Petty. Mm-hmm. The chorus sounds exactly like Tom Petty's You Won't Back Down. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is that's the only place that they overlap. Now, that one might be a little closer to copyright infringement, but like, to me, I was like, well, those are three notes that are picked out of the arpeggio of the chord progression, and I guarantee you I can find many, many songs in the past that did exactly that same melody against right. those same chords.
Pop music repeats itself.
Yeah, and then you think about the blues, where mm-hmm. Or electronic, certain styles of electronic dance music and stuff like that, there are a lot of shared motifs that the copyright law, you know, copyright law says things has to, you know, it's not defined, but it says it has to be unique enough to be copyrightable, basically, right? Mm-hmm. And that means it can't be things like, you know, a chord progression that the blues is based on, right? It's like that is part of the Creative Commons of that style of music and stuff like that. So I've long considered myself more on the dovish side. It's just when we got to the digital realm, I sort of drew the line and I kind of became known as a hawk. And in some ways I've got a little more hawkish on some issues because I see if, you know, certain things like, well, if you allow that, then where do you stop? You know, mm-hmm. but no, I'm a jackalope. I'm a copyright jackalope. I think you got it. Thanks.
David, thank you so much for joining us on Lost in the Stacks again. And I hope you come back sometime.
Appreciate it. I love doing this show. So thank you.
File this set under TUSK.
Fred Tusk? What? That's not even a set class. That was Brown Eyes by Camper Van Beethoven, a cover of Brown Eyes by Fleetwood Mac, which we started the set with. So you heard them one after another. Did Camper's version adhere to the original faithfully enough to be covered by the performance license? Or was there significant comment and interpretation to require reliance on fair use? Such an odd construction, something to ponder.
Charlie, what is going on at the library next week?
Tusk! Sorry. I imagine a number of folks will use the internet to look up the text of H.R. 1695, House Resolution 1695, Register of Copyright Selection and Accountability Act of 2017. Or not. I don't know. Who's to say? We are the Georgia Tech Library, and we are at your whatever-you-need service.
Lost in the Stacks is a collaboration between WREK Atlanta and the Georgia Tech Library, produced by Amit Doshi, Charlie Bennett, Wendy Hagenmeyer, and Fred Rasko.
Josh was our engineer today, and our show was brought to you by Section 107 of U.S. Copyright Law.
Legal counsel and photographic evidence of the existence of jackalopes.
Whoa!
Were provided by the Burris Intellectual Property Law Group in Atlanta, Georgia.
Special thanks to David the Jackalope for being on the show, and thanks, as always, to each and every one of you for listening.
Find us online at lostinthestacks.org, and you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Google Play. And by the way, there's more to the interview that we didn't get to broadcast, so if you want to hear the full-length version, it'll go out on the podcast feed next week.
Next week on Lost in the Stacks, we're going to run. We're going to run to the city of refuge. Data refuge, that is.
It's time for our last song today. Occasionally on our show, we'll tip our hats to music artists that have recently passed away.
Uh-oh.
Since our last live episode, we lost a giant of rock and roll. You might say the giant of rock and roll. Chuck Berry. Okay, as a human being, he was, you might say,
emblematic of the transgressive and confrontational nature of rock and roll itself.
That's a polite and generous way to avoid speaking ill of the dead. But as an artist, he was one of the granite slabs on which the edifice of rock and roll was built. So let's close with Chuck Berry's Too Much Monkey Business right here on Lost in the Stacks. Have a great weekend, everybody.